Welcome to 30 Minutes of VOA Learning English, the voice of America's information service for people learning English. Join us now for our daily magazine show, As It Is, and other programs designed for English learners.
Hello, and welcome to As It Is from VOA Learning English. I'm Christopher Cruz in Washington. Today on the program, we look at the effect of the sharp drop in oil prices on workers in the southwestern American state of Texas, where oil is very important to the economy. Then, we go to the Library of Congress to look at the book collection of a former American president. 200 years ago, Thomas Jefferson's books helped the library begin again after the British burned many of the library's books in the early 1800s. How low oil prices are both good and bad for Texas, and how the Library of Congress rose from the ashes thanks to America's third president. Those are our stories today. We're on the radio, on the web, and we come to you on a podcast. We are wherever you are. We're the voice of America, and this is our daily program, As It Is. The sharp drop in world oil prices has led oil companies in the United States to dismiss thousands of workers. Some companies have also suspended new oil drilling and exploration projects. The drop in oil prices has also affected small service companies and even stores that do business with oil companies in big producer states like Texas. But the drop in oil prices has not been bad for everyone. Oil platform workers are often called roughnecks. In Texas, many roughnecks have lost their jobs because of the drop in oil prices. The effect of falling prices has been worse in states like Alaska and North Dakota. That is because production costs are higher there than they are in the Eagle Ford area of South Central Texas. Some oil drilling projects are working to keep their costs low. If the price of oil stays above $40 a barrel, they can still make a profit. Adam Perdue is an economist at the University of Houston's Institute for Regional Forecasting. He has been studying the effect of falling oil prices in Texas. Mr. Perdue says oil company exploration and production budgets are being cut between 10% and 50%, with most of them being cut by a third. He says the city of Houston experienced 5% growth rates in recent years. He thinks the lower spending will affect the local economy.
We're predicting that there's going to be 20,000 fewer jobs than there would have been otherwise. So we're still predicting growth in the Houston area. It's just going to slow down to a more reasonable rate of about or just under 2%.
The economic slowdown will affect companies that manufacture pipes and other equipment for oil exploration and production. It will also have an effect on trucking companies that supply sand and chemicals and other small businesses that serve the energy industry. But low oil prices are good for chemical companies. They use hydrocarbons found in oil to make fertilizer, plastic, and other products. Adam Perdue says a new chemical plant project near Houston will provide jobs for many skilled workers.
A lot of these roughnecks that are going to lose their jobs out there in the fields are going to be able to come home and get a welding job or a construction job.
He says oil industry experts believe prices will rise again in about 6 months when the oversupply of oil is reduced. Experts say the oversupply resulted from expanded production. But he says if those predictions are wrong and oil prices continue to fall, the economy of Houston and Texas will be hurt much more. You are listening to As It Is on the Voice of America. The United States Library of Congress is the largest library in the world. It has a huge collection of books and other sources of information, including documents, maps, and photographs. The Library of Congress opened in 1801. Its first home was the U.S. Capitol Building. The United States and Britain fought during the War of 1812. During the war, British forces burned the Capitol, destroying many of the library's 3,000 books. The third U.S. President, Thomas Jefferson, offered his personal library as a replacement. At the time, Jefferson had the largest personal collection of books in the country. In those times, books were costly. Most were made in Europe and shipped to the United States. Jefferson bought some of the books when he was serving as a diplomat in France. Jefferson had been born into a wealthy family, so he was able to buy the books he wanted. 200 years ago, on January 30, 1815, Congress bought Jefferson's collection of 6,487 books for $23,950. After the purchase, the Library of Congress had more than two times as many books as it had when the British attacked. Today, many of Jefferson's books are permanently displayed at the library. Thomas Jefferson loved books and learning. He collected books on almost any subject. Mark Diminution is chief of rare books and special collections at the Library of Congress.
He liked books about clever invention, massive holdings on law, and then his great love, architecture.
He says the original library was very different from Jefferson's collection.
It was a working library that members of Congress would need: law, trade, dictionaries, some classical history.
Mark Diminution says Jefferson's many interests changed the Library of Congress's approach to collecting.
It completely altered the notion of what was appropriate for that collection, from needlepoint designs to architecture.
In 1851, a fire in the U.S. Capitol destroyed many books in the library and almost two-thirds of Jefferson's collection. After the fire, a large and beautiful building was put up across the street from the Capitol for the Library of Congress. That's our program for today. We'll be back tomorrow at this same time with another broadcast, webcast, and podcast edition of As It Is from the Voice of America.
Coming up, more programs designed for English learners. You can read and listen to our reports and download MP3s at learningenglish.voanews.com. You can learn with us on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at VOA Learning English.
From VOA Learning English, this is the Technology Report. Imagine a camera that can take 100 billion pictures a second. That is enough to record the fastest movements in the universe. But we do not have to imagine it because a scientist has invented such a camera. He calls it an imaging system. It may seem like science fiction, but it is science reality. Li Hung Wong is a biomedical engineer at Washington University in St. Louis, Missouri. He leads a team of researchers who have discovered several new imaging techniques.
For the first time, humans can literally see light pulses traveling in space at the speed of light.
The speed of light is almost 300 million meters per second. At that speed, it would take just 1 second to travel around the world 7.5 times. Mr. Wong photographs light particles moving at that speed using a unique camera.
The street camera is a very specialized device that allows us to convert time into space. We convert light particles or photons into electrons, then pull the electrons really hard at different rates depending on the time of arrival. So the time of arrival will be converted into different vertical positions.
Mr. Wong's new technology improves on other ultra-fast cameras in important ways. Until now, streak cameras could only take a one-dimensional photograph. That is like looking through a vertical opening and trying to take a picture of something flying by really fast. The fastest cameras had to have an external or outside light source to work. But Mr. Wong's technique does not need special lighting. It produces two-dimensional images like regular photographs, but at a speed of one image every 10 trillionths of a second. Brian Pogue is a biomedical engineer at Dartmouth College in the eastern American state of New Hampshire. He reviewed the new imaging system for the science publication Nature. He says this new way of seeing the movement of light could lead to major scientific discoveries in areas like optical cloaking. Cloaking is a kind of technology that can make an object, like a spaceship, seem to disappear. Mr. Pogue says the military would like to use cloaking.
There's a lot of interest in, you know, getting light to bend around objects so it sort of looks like you're seeing through them.
Brian Pogue says Mr. Wong's new system lets researchers photograph light as it bends. He says they have not been able to do that until now. He says this development could help make optical cloaking a reality. Li Hung Wong imagines other uses for the new camera in such scientific fields as molecular biology and astronomy. He says ultra-fast imaging could lead to new discoveries. And that's the VOA Learning English Technology Report. For more technology stories, go to our website, learningenglish.voanews.com. I'm Jonathan Evans.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. The Civil War ended in 1865. After that, tensions grew between Congress and the new president, Andrew Johnson. The Republican Party was still new. It was formed to oppose slavery. Radical members of the party controlled Congress. They wanted strong policies to punish the southern states that left the Union and lost the war. Standing in the way of the Republicans was Andrew Johnson, a Democrat. The president opposed radical efforts to force solutions on the South. He vetoed a number of programs that he thought interfered with rights given to the states by the Constitution. This week in our series, Kay Gallant and Harry Monroe continue the story of President Andrew Johnson.
In the congressional elections of 1866, radicals won firm control of both houses of Congress. They were able to pass a number of bills over the president's veto. But Johnson refused to stand aside in the face of radical attempts to seize all powers of government. This conflict between Johnson and the Congress caused much bitterness. Finally, the radicals decided to get him out of the way. For the first time in American history, Congress would try to remove the president from office. Under the United States Constitution, the House of Representatives has the power to bring charges against the president. The Senate acts as the jury to decide if the president is guilty of the charges. The Chief Justice of the United States serves as judge. If two-thirds of the senators find the president guilty, he can be removed from office.
Radicals in the House of Representatives brought 11 charges against President Johnson. Most of the charges were based on Johnson's removal from office of his Secretary of War. Radicals charged that this violated a new law. The law said the president could not remove a cabinet officer without approval by the Senate. Johnson refused to recognize the law. He said it was not constitutional. Radicals in the House of Representatives also charged Johnson with criticizing Congress. They said his statements dishonored Congress and the presidency.
The great impeachment trial began on March 5, 1868. The president refused to attend, but his lawyers were there to defend him. One by one, the senators swore an oath to be just. They promised to make a fair and honest decision on the guilt or innocence of Andrew Johnson. A congressman from Massachusetts opened the case for the radicals. He told the senators not to think of themselves as members of any court. He said the Senate was a political body that was being asked to settle a political question. Was Johnson the right man for the White House? He said it was clear that Johnson wanted to overthrow Congress. Other radical Republicans then joined him in condemning Johnson. They made many charges, but they offered little evidence to support the charges.
Johnson's lawyers called for facts instead of emotion. They said the Constitution required the radicals to prove that the president had committed serious crimes. Andrew Johnson had committed no crime, they said. This was purely a political trial. They warned of serious damage to the American form of government if the president was removed for political reasons. No future president would be safe, they said, if opposed by a majority of the House and two-thirds of the Senate.
The trial went on day after day. The decision would be close. 54 senators would be voting. 36 votes of guilty were needed to remove the president from office. It soon became clear that the radicals had 35 of these votes. Only 7 senators remained undecided. If one of the 7 voted guilty, Johnson would be removed. Radicals put great pressure on the 7 men. They tried to buy their votes. Party leaders threatened them. Supporters in the senators' home states were told to write hundreds of letters demanding that Johnson be found guilty.
A senator from Maine was one who felt the pressure, but he refused to let it force him to do what others wished. He answered one letter this way: "Sir, I wish you and all my other friends to know that I, not they, am sitting in judgment upon the president. I, not they, have sworn to do impartial justice. I, not they, am responsible to God and man for my action and its results." A senator from Kansas was another who refused to let pressure decide his vote. He said, "I trust that I shall have the courage to vote as I judge best."
In the final days before the vote, 6 of the 7 remaining Republican senators let it be known that they would vote not guilty. But the senator from Kansas still refused to say what his vote would be. His was the only vote still in question. His vote would decide the issue. Now, the pressure on him increased. His brother was offered $20,000 for information about how the senator would vote. Everywhere he turned, he found someone demanding that he vote guilty. The vote took place on May 16th. Every seat in the big Senate room was filled. The Chief Justice began to call on the senators. One by one, they answered, "guilty" or "not guilty." Finally, he called the name of the senator from Kansas.
The senator stood up. He looked about him. Every voice was still. Every eye was upon him. "It was like looking down into an open grave," he said later. "Friendship, position, wealth, everything that makes life desirable to an ambitious man were about to be swept away by my answer." He spoke softly. Many could not hear him. The Chief Justice asked him to repeat his vote. This time, the answer was clearly heard across the room. not guilty.
The trial was all but done. Remaining senators voted as expected. The Chief Justice announced the result. On the first charge, 35 senators voted that President Johnson was guilty. 19 voted that he was not guilty. The radicals had failed by one vote. When the Senate voted on the other charges, the result was the same. The radicals could not get the two-thirds majority they needed. President Johnson was declared not guilty.
Radical leaders and newspapers bitterly denounced the small group of Republican senators who refused to vote guilty. They called them traitors. Friends and supporters condemned them. None was re-elected to the Senate or to any other government office. It was a heavy price to pay, and yet they were sure they had done the right thing. The senator from Kansas told his wife, "The millions of men cursing me today will bless me tomorrow for having saved the country from the greatest threat it ever faced."
He was right. The trial of Andrew Johnson was an important turning point in the making of the American nation. His removal from office would have established the idea that the president could serve only with the approval of Congress. The president would have become, in effect, a prime minister. He would have to depend on the support of Congress to remain in office. Johnson's victory kept alive the idea of an independent presidency. However, the vote did not end the conflict between Congress and the White House over the future of the South. That will be our story in the next program of The Making of a Nation.
Our program was written by David Jarmel and Frank Beardsley. The narrators were Kay Gallant and Harry Monroe. Transcripts, podcasts, and historical images from our series are at voaspecialenglish.com. You can also comment on our programs, and you can follow us on Twitter at VOA Learning English. Join us again next week for The Making of a Nation, an American history series in VOA Special English.